It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 76 for Friday, the 18th of May, 2012. On the show today, will you be buying part of Facebook? The social network lands on the stock market this week, but not without some controversy. Twitter has quite literally been buzzing this week as well, as one of the enterprising beekeepers of the world decided to turn his beehives into automatic tweeting machines, with cameras and sensors keeping us up to date with all the goings-on in the insect world. And would you buy a game that kicks you out whenever your internet connection goes down? That's a measure World of Warcraft maker Blizzard has implemented in its new game Diablo 3, and some of us are voting against it with our wallets. All that and more coming up. Ahoy there, Nate Langson here, editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, Duncan Gear.
Hello.
And of course, Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
No, it's been a little while since I've been able to grace your ears.
It has. You've been, where were you last
week? I've been all over the place. I was in Sweden, and then I was in Denmark, and then I was in Brighton.
Gallivanting.
I was gallivanting.
Really? What was the most intriguing thing that you found on your gallivantian trip?
It was probably a Japanese band called Triple Nipples, who were excellent. They were playing at the Great Escape in Brighton last week, and they are a lot of fun.
Fabulous. Well, there's no nipples in today's lineup, but we are going to start out with Facebook. Liv, it is possible to buy part of Facebook. This is big news. It sounds dull, but it's actually very important.
Well, it's massive news, but I guess the kind of in the run-up to this big news, there have been a few kind of murmurings of dissent from different parts of the world, including General Motors, who said that the advertising, they're not going to be advertising on Facebook anymore because, the implication was that it does not working for them.
Oh, the pages, these are the Facebook pages, right?
No. This is the paid ads on Facebook. So the actual thing that Facebook makes its money from, as opposed to the free pages where you can just populate it for free. So they're pulling out $10 million from advertising on Facebook.
This is kind of a worrying thing to happen the week you're about to go public in one of the biggest tech IPOs ever.
It is. I guess it could have been fairly kind of tactically timed, and there's a heightened sense of interest about Facebook, so all these stories might be coming out of the woodwork. But there was another study that came out saying 44% of Facebook users will never click sponsored posts or display ads. And actually, I think the kind of bigger news is the fact that 56% of people will.
Yeah. Duncan, when was the last time you clicked an ad on Facebook?
I've clicked them in the past. Like, occasionally, a little while back, I think, when I was living in Reading, I clicked one because there was some band that was playing nearby and I liked that band. So it was really well targeted because it was like people in this area that have listed these bands on their profile would probably like us.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so I clicked it. And that's a really good application of it. But I would never click on General Motors or anything like that. I mean, I don't drive to start with. But
yeah. But I mean, I guess that's the point. If it's not targeted, it's not. You're never going to click it. But that doesn't seem to be holding back the IPO. Facebook's already announced that it's going to be releasing even more shares, making 25% more available. So it'll raise a total of $16 billion.
Wow. Happy days to be Zuckerberg. Well, actually, I suppose happier days to be a Facebook employee that can finally benefit from actually sticking with Zuckerberg's intention to not go public for years.
Well, yeah, all the kind of graffiti artists who got paid in stock who can now, buy his island and live the dream.
You know, years ago, Mark Zuckerberg turned down a $1 billion acquisition offer from Yahoo. Could you imagine how much balls that must have taken?
Yeah.
He must have been about 19 at the time, turning $1 billion down, and now they're going public for raising $16 billion.
Valuing the company at $100 billion.
We've got some features and things on the site, I think, if you're interested in finding out more about Facebook's IPO. Haven't we, Liv?
We have, yes. Lots of stories there, so just search.
I like that you're pronouncing it like hippo.
IPO.
IPO.
I think that should be made compulsory from now on.
Really?
Yeah, for everyone.
Well, we'll see.
We'll have to lowercase the P and the O. On that reading.
Yes, that's true.
Fascinating news there. More fascinating, perhaps, is something called, I'm not going to try and pronounce it because it would sound like IPOXP.
Unlike the IPO, actually.
Absolutely, that's very true. Duncan, xylophones and IP networking, what's going on here?
I think the connection here is that they both start with IP and O.
Mm.
This is a guy from the University of California, Berkeley. His name's Stuart Geiger, and he's managed to implement an IP network over xylophones.
IP being internet protocol, i.e. the thing that makes the network.
Yes, correct. It's a way of two computers talking to each other. He's built a kind of system where two Arduino microcontrollers are hooked up to a bunch of LEDs, a pair of xylophones, and some piezoelectric sensors. And then two volunteers are playing tunes kind of generated by the data that's being sent from each other's computer, which is then heard by the other xylophone and turned back into data again.
You know, sometimes when you tell me these amazing pieces of news, like man does amazing X with Y, I always wonder why. Why is he doing this?
I mean, it's just because to see if he can, really. The way it kind of works is that a computer will send the data that it wants to transmit to the Arduino in ASCII format, which is converted into hex code. But each hexadecimal character is linked to an LED, which is positioned above a note on the xylophone. So basically, each note on the xylophone corresponds to a different character. When the LED lights up, then the volunteer plays that note. And then once played, the note is picked up by the sensors on the opposite xylophone, which converts it back into hex and passes it to the other computer. And these characters are kind of issued at a rate of about 1 per second, which gives the network a one board throughput.
Oh, that's old school.
Yeah.
What if one of the players decides to play off key or just like isn't there to play the note?
Then the other computer will reject the package. It takes about 15 minutes to transmit a packet of data on this thing, so it's a bit of a waste of time if one person gets it wrong.
Yeah.
But yeah, if the musician doesn't hit any wrong notes, then it takes about 15 minutes to transmit a packet of data. One thing that the guy Geiger found quite difficult is stopping the volunteers from getting distracted during those 15 minutes, because basically they're just playing a note a second.
Yeah.
For 15 minutes, and that's a little dull. So what he did is he encased them in black cardboard boxes to stop them getting distracted by their environment.
I think it'd be really interesting to see what this would sound like if you did it the exact other way around and tried to interpret what data you could get out of something like Beethoven's Fifth.
Yes, that's entirely possible. I mean, it would probably just be absolute nonsense.
It would just be noise, but it'd be quite interesting. Or do it with one of those, you know, those data bending techniques where you sort of take raw data and bend it around but turn it into art.
Yes.
And you print out. That could work quite well.
That's also possible, Drew. But it's not the first time that IP has been implemented on sort of weird things. A team back in the 90s tried to do IP over... They successfully managed to implement IP over carrier pigeons. And there's also been an IP over bongo drums project in the
Actually,
past.
I'd sign up for the bongo one. I play the djembe. I could absolutely become a router. Think about it. A human repeater.
I'm thinking about it.
I think that's a career for you, Nate.
I don't know. There was an Australian African network that proved that it was faster to send data on a USB key via pigeon than it was to use the country's broadband on a particular network or something. Amusing.
Fact.
Let's stay on the topic of networks, because Apple, under pressure from advertising regulator Ofcom, or the ASA, I think, actually, has been forced not to call its new iPad Wi-Fi plus 4G and instead call it Wi-Fi plus cellular. There have been a lot of complaints from people in the UK and around the world, actually, that because Britain doesn't have 4G, and when it does, it won't be compatible with the type of 4G that the iPad uses, it's misleading for Apple to call it Wi-Fi plus 4G in its 3G, 4G model.
Now, is this the first place in the world where that's happened? Because I know that there have been complaints about the advertising in other countries.
Yeah, it happened in Australia.
And did they do the same thing there, do you know?
I don't actually know if they did the same thing there.
Okay.
But the thing is, it makes sense because pretty much anywhere outside of the US at the moment isn't going to be able to use this network. So it's kind of, it is a little bit misleading to call it 4G. The only thing that complicates this, and we've talked about this on the show before, is that Britain has at the moment some very fast 3G, and we're about to get even faster 3G. And a lot of the speeds that you can get on these faster 3G networks that we have here are actually comparable to some of the real world speeds that some people have been reporting getting on 4G in the US. And so although we don't have something that's branded 4G, the speeds could be, you know, comparable. So it's kind of a weird thing to...
So is that why they use the weird word cellular?
Well, they've used plus, I think cellular is, I mean, they just call it more, they call it that in the US more. We don't really say a cellular network.
No.
But
and it wouldn't really work if they said Wi-Fi on mobile, which is kind of our equivalent.
Yeah, or Wi-Fi plus HSPA plus.
Yeah.
Or,
but there's an awful lot of difference around the world as to what is called 4G, isn't that right?
Yeah, well, in the US, say if you look at AT&T, they're using LTE, long-term evolution 4G, on certain specific bands. And in the same way that you have, radio stations have different frequencies in the UK, the same thing is sort of true with with all radio spectrum, and LTE uses certain bands in the US that when we eventually do have 4G LTE rolling out in this country, it won't necessarily use the same band. So even though the underlying technology is the same, it doesn't mean that these devices sold now are going to be compatible with networks in the future. So essentially, ASA, I think, is sort of future-proofing consumer satisfaction.
Well, good for them.
Yes, good for them. I think it's the right move. I think actually the numbers on paper probably mean that people might get similar speeds depending on where you are, but it's probably the right way to go. Duncan, I want to talk about space.
You always want to talk about space.
Astronauts.
Yep.
Specifically, they are training for a potential mission to an asteroid.
But not in space.
No.
Well, the asteroids in space, they're not going to be in space.
Tell me more, Duncan. I want to know.
NASA is preparing plans to send an unmanned spacecraft to an asteroid around 2016. And Obama's also asked them to prepare a manned mission in the late 2020s to follow it up, a kind of like, what was the movie where they went and landed on an asteroid? Was it Armageddon?
Yeah. Okay. Yes, where they drilled.
They drilled into the asteroid. Yes, correct. They're kind of like looking at lots of different asteroids, which could be up to 4 million kilometers away, which is quite a lot further than the moon, which is 400,000 kilometers away. But it's a lot closer than Mars, which has also been another target for human exploration. That's 56 million kilometers away. So an asteroid is a nice kind of like halfway step between the two. They reckon that a trip to an asteroid would take about a year, and the astronauts would stay on this thing for about a month. And so to prepare for this, a collection of astronauts are being flown to an underwater base where they're going to live for 12 days about 20 meters below the surface.
Wow. And again, we talked
just in a box.
So hang on, what do you mean flown to an underwater base?
Well, they're being flown to a place and then they'll get off the plane and then go underwater and then go into the thing.
Where are these underwater bases?
I think they're building one specifically.
I love this sort of thing. I think it's awesome. Absolutely brilliant when they do these experiments where
Would you do it?
No. I mean,
really?
12 no. days? That's not bad.
I could do 12 days. But like the one where the Mars mission, where we mentioned it last week, the Russians who were locked up for 4 years. I mean, it's madness.
Well, that was in training for a trip to Mars, wasn't it?
It was,
an asteroid.
Although there's similar vibe.
I like the way all this asteroid stuff's going, because we've talked recently about the planetary resources mission that Google et al. Is behind, with the mission to basically go mine some of these asteroids.
So to get the resources out of them.
Yeah, and now we're talking about manned missions to asteroids. It's all coming together. Are asteroids our future? They're the big questions we're asking today.
But yeah, I mean, this technology is basically about testing both humans and the science behind it for future human missions to other planets. Well, in the solar system, obviously within our lifetime, but, you know, potentially further afield later on, depending on how things go.
Colour me excited, Duncan. Colour me excited.
All right, I will.
Okay, thanks. Liv, probably the most weird kind of social networking story we've had on the site in recent moons is that a dude with a lot of bees has created a socially networked beehive.
He has, yeah. I mean, honeybees always seem to get all the attention. We do quite a lot of stories about honeybees, but bumblebees we don't talk about quite so much.
The humble bumble
we do not talk about. And
what's all this about? You've been learning a lot about bees recently.
I learned a lot about bees. Yesterday I spoke to a guy called Nick Sargent, whose day job is an IT strategist, but in his spare time he's a kind of hacker and hobbyist and beekeeper. And he looked into initially keeping honeybees last year, but found they were too complicated to look after. And so looked into bumblebees. And since in the last year, he's kind of built up a special kind of bumblebee nest. And he's completely pimped it out with sensors. He's got 7 cameras looking at different angles. He's got local temperature sensors, light sensors, motion sensors, a trackable door that measures the kind of comings and goings of the bees, microphones. And then he's got a kind of weather station outside to kind of keep track of the kind of climate over the months.
There was a sample tweet, wasn't there?
There was.
Do we have the sample tweet?
Oh, we don't have it to hand. But what he does is he has a door on the house, on the bee house, and that prevents a nasty predator called a wax moth from getting in. But the door has a little sensor on it every time it moves. And so that gives an indication of how much activity there is. And when it hits a certain number of moves per 10 minutes, I think 500 is the highest, it'll send out a tweet saying, "We're very busy at the moment. We're busy little bees." And if it's a bit lower, it'll say, "We're moderately busy." And then if it's lower, that is says kind of we're lazy, we're just, you know, slacking at the moment.
Does he have a goal for all this, or is he just doing it because it's incredibly awesome?
He has got a goal, actually. He really wants to do a PhD, but he doesn't think he can afford to quit his job. But he's really interested in how the temperature, very localized temperature, but also the kind of wider kind of weather, the climate, is affecting bumblebee behavior. And he's kind of at the moment in the data collection stage. He's got a huge dashboard that measures all these different things, but he wants to try and show that their kind of reproductive patterns are changing because of things like the warm March this year. He said he noticed loads of queen bees being born and leaving the nest when they should have been, you know, much later in the year, for example. But there's some really nice little touches. He's got a website which is absolutely kind of obsessive about this thing, but he does things like look after disabled bees indoors. Aww. And monitors their behavior. But he has bigger plans. He wants to do things like add RFID to the bees and live stream some of the videos that he's creating.
That would be awesome. Actually, that's very similar to what the thing that we went to see the other week, wasn't it?
The dinosaur ants.
Yeah, the girl at the PhD student at, what was it, London Zoological Society.
Correct.
Who'd put these RFID tags on the back of these giant ants. These are big old ants.
Yeah.
Like they're like, what are they, an inch, 2 inches long maybe?
Something like that.
RFID chips on the back of them so they could monitor their comings and goings in this, yeah, sort of fake nest hive. They should meet up.
They should. They
could probably share. What could they share?
Notes.
Yeah, probably.
Were you trying to think of a pun then?
I was. I was actually getting a bit distracted by all this talk of like the cameras inside the hive. It is a reality TV show waiting to happen.
It is.
David Attenborough style.
They could even voice them like Meerkat Manor, but with bees.
Never heard of that.
You haven't?
No.
Oh.
I think you'd be a big fan.
Would I?
Yeah.
Almost certainly.
It's kind of documentary footage of meerkats, but voiced with human by human actors.
Colour me excited for a second time in 10 minutes. That sounds awesome. Well, while I ponder my evening's entertainment with meerkats, it's time for us to take a quick break. And when we come back, why am I refusing to buy Diablo 3? There's one very good reason coming up.
Wired magazine, published digitally every month on iPad. Now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
We're back. We're back. We're live and kicking. Duncan, I'm going to ask you a question. If I told you there was a game, and I know your answer to this, by the way.
What's my answer going to be?
Your answer is going to be, yes, of course I would. Okay. Can you guess my question? All right. If I said there was a game, Liv, there was a game that you paid your money for, you play it, and then your internet connection goes down. It's just you playing the game, and you're booted out of the game because maybe your Virgin Media connection, your BT or whatever, just copped out for like a minute or something.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you were returned to the login screen. You'd be like, what the heck?
I would say, oh, you dirty little scoundrel, you.
Well, that's what I've been saying. This is what Diablo 3 is doing. It's a new game from Blizzard. They're the guys that make World of Warcraft. And the game requires that you are permanently connected to the internet in order to play. If your connection goes offline or you go somewhere with no internet, I mean, it's an action RPG. It takes a lot of time. You might want to play it in a cafe where you don't have internet access. Then you're kicked out of the game. You cannot play.
Now, I'm going to make a guess here.
Go on.
I'm going to make a guess and say that you're not very happy about this.
I am miffed to the max.
I thought you might be.
Maximum level of miffed I am. I really, really, really want to play this game. I'd happily pay for it. It's about 40 quid. I'd happily pay for it. It's been 12 years since Diablo 2, and I'm refusing. I'm taking a stand because I think that this is the wrong way to tackle all kinds of anti-cheating, anti-piracy, to force you to be online to play a game.
Okay, so you've sort of hinted at that. Why are they doing it?
Well, there are two reasons. There's one reason that they've given, which is to stop people cheating, right? So the game, you can play on your own, but it's sort of part of a wider online world, if you like. So you can take your character and have kind of international interactions with it, if you like, online interactions. I don't know what the official term would be. And so they reckon
multiplayer.
And that they, well, it's not really multiplayer though, is it? It's co-op. All right, if you like.
It's
and their argument is that if you were allowed, you know, you could cheat while playing the game by yourself, and then if you took your character into one of these cooperative multiplayer environments, you would be an unfair advantage.
Sorry, what do you mean cheat? How would you cheat?
Well, if you cheated, like if you modded your game so that your character was really strong, or you had loads of extra money, or if you had, you know, if you'd managed to ramp up the power of your weapons in the game or something like that. Had loads of in-game benefits that you can do by just hacking the game, because it's a PC game, and so they're much easier, and for a lot of games, encouraged to sort of mod and hack and cheat to sort of change the game experience. And they reckon that if you're allowed to do that, or whether you did it, whether you were allowed to or not, and then took the game into an online multiplayer environment, you would be at a disadvantage. So they force you to be online for the whole time in order to prevent cheating. And the other knock-on effect of that, of course, is anti-piracy. If you have to be online all the time to play the game, then they can tell whether you've pirated the game or not.
Well, I mean, that will almost certainly last about a week before it gets cracked and is available on the web anyway.
I had a quick look, actually, before we came down, and you can download the game on BitTorrent, but I couldn't find any, like, cracked or patched version, so it hasn't happened
yet. I'm sure it's
yet.
Only a matter of time. But yeah. I mean, so the way other games have dealt with this situation is to basically say you can have your single player characters that are offline, and then you have your multiplayer characters which are online, and you just choose between each one, and you can't transfer between the two. So if you create a character that you know you want to take online, you make an online one.
Okay, yeah. So you can still do all the kind of hacks on your offline character.
No, that's the thing. In some of these games that Duncan mentions, you can. In this one, you can't do any of that. There's no option. You have to be online all the time.
Okay.
And I think that's wrong. I mean, my suggestion, I wrote a big article about this on the website, and we'll talk about some of the comments that it received in a bit. But my suggestion was that if you had an offline mode, what you could basically be saying, you're not going to be able to take any advantage of these online features if you choose to have an offline character. It's offline forever. Do you want to do that? And if you say yes, then it's your fault that you can't take the character online.
To play devil's advocate, is kind of cheating a big complaint from players of these games?
It was sort of an issue in Diablo 2. There was a certain amount of cheating in that. And certainly in kind of more popular games, there is an element of cheating, especially when it comes to player versus player games, where you're competing against other characters rather than playing cooperatively.
And so, is it fair to say there might be quite a few people who've kind of asked for stronger measures to prevent cheating, whether or not this is the right measure? But there might have been a movement in that direction.
There may have been, but I think more likely is that the games developers are thinking, you know, we're basically living in a different world now where people are online all the time, and this probably isn't an issue, and we can prevent some problems by enforcing it.
Well, I mean, there's probably quite a lot of people sitting at home thinking that, well, I am online all the time, you know, why is this a problem? You know, I might get kicked out maybe once in like 2 months or something like that, but it shouldn't be an issue. But the problem with that is that then the game becomes unplayable for other people. Like if you go on a plane, you can't play it, or if you're in the army and you're stationed in Afghanistan or something like that, then you can't play it. And there's lots of situations that completely valid situations where you might just want to be offline.
This is my problem. I mean, I actually have a 12-hour flight next week. I've got a flight to Washington, and I would otherwise take my Mac on the plane and probably play Diablo because I've got a lot of time to kill. I couldn't do that. This measure would physically stop me playing that game that I've paid for because I couldn't get online. And I don't think that's the way to tackle anything like this. I mean, Ubisoft has done this a lot in the past with some of its games, where the games require a permanent internet connection for copy protection reasons. They reckon, you know, to make sure you haven't pirated this game, we're going to keep this permanent internet connection open. And it's meant that when their servers are maxed out, or on one occasion they had to actually take their servers offline for maintenance and upgrade, it meant people physically couldn't play the game. The people who pirated the game, of course, not affected.
Yeah.
So you're punished.
There's been a massive backlash against Ubisoft stuff. And there's been a massive backlash against Blizzard as well, which we're contributing to right now.
We are. But one comment I wanted to point out as well is that, I mean, we've had a few comments on this story. One that I think makes a lot of sense from Vincent Thacker. I mean, he was in agreement with me, but he was talking about the fact that his internet is currently down and he's waiting for an engineer to come around on Friday, which means that between the game coming out earlier this week and Friday, he would have paid his £40 and not been able to play it purely because his internet was down, which I don't think that should be a problem. I think, all right, it sucks that you can't play the online features or whatever, but you shouldn't be stopped from playing the game. And there are many people who have replied to some of my tweets and things who have said that they didn't realize this and they're not going to buy it as a result, or that they bought it not knowing this and then got, you know, penalized because their connection was flaky or something.
Yeah, I think Wookie sort of echoed a point that you made earlier. Who he said that DRM is a very good reason to run a crack version that doesn't require an internet connection, and that actually employing these kinds of measures encourages piracy rather than solves it.
Mm. There was one guy called Sheldon who called me a hipster, which might be the first time I've ever been called a hipster. But he says, "I highly doubt Blizzard would care about your wallet. Millions of people have already bought it and are enjoying the awesomeness. Stop being a hipster and get yourself an internet connection and join." join the rest of the world. The problem is, I do have an internet connection, but it's on principle. This is a principle here.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm afraid I'm one of the millions of people who have bought it and am enjoying the awesomeness. It is a fantastic, fantastic game as far as I've played so far. And I played quite a lot of the beta and yeah, I'm playing the full version now. And it's great. It's such a good game. It's just, it's such a shame that there's this DRM issue overshadowing it.
Yep, I agree. It's annoying, says Sam Shepard. Imagine if music or movie studios did the same and required your TV or stereo to always be connected, totally onside. Although it did remind me a little bit of Sony's rootkit thing. Do you remember a few years ago when Sony put rootkit
10 years ago now, 11 years
to stop you playing copying CDs, you couldn't play the CD on your computer to try and stop piracy. That ended in hell.
So Duncan, in your playings of the game, have you seen any benefits over and above the ones that Blizzard mentioned from having a kind of permanent web connection?
Not especially. I mean, one thing that's kind of nice is that I don't have like saved games stored on my hard drive. Mm. So if I have, say, a laptop at work and I've got my main game at home, I can just log into it from either place and I can just carry on exactly where I left off. I don't have to shuttle save games around, which you do in other ones. But it's entirely possible to run that kind of service anyway without kind of employing this sort of always-on thing.
Yeah, Steam does that. On Steam, they have Steam Cloud, is it? Something like
Steam
that?
Steam Play, I think
Steam
it is.
Steam Play, where you're, you know, many of its games... you're allowed to save it. It saves it to a cloud, and if you log in on another machine, all your saves are there. And that's really useful as well if you install the game on, you know, your work machine, for example. Mm. I don't know. Let us know what you think. podcast@wired.co.uk, our Facebook page as well, facebook.com/ what are we? Wired UK.
Wired UK.
Or search for Diablo 3 and go and, you know, tell me what you think about my decision not to pay for this game.
Leave a comment.
Whether he's a hipster or not.
Duncan, let's talk about digital music. Last item on today's agenda. It's drowning in filler drivel, according to a story you wrote earlier this week.
Well, actually, according to a chap called Mark Mulligan, who's a music industry analyst.
I learnt it from your article.
Yes, I was reporting his words. He said that the catalogues of popular artists on digital music services are being swamped by covers and tribute acts and karaoke acts, and that this is having a negative effect on music discovery.
Okay, and how does this manifest itself? How can you tell if you're drowning in drivel?
it's easy to see, and almost everybody listening will have seen this, that you search for Lady Gaga, and it'll come up with a few Lady Gaga songs, and then Lady Gaga karaoke, and Lady Gaga tribute, and Lady Gaga blah, blah, blah. And there's, in many cases, 10 times as much nonsense as there is actual songs by Lady Gaga, and that this is becoming a problem.
I actually did see that before the Beatles were on iTunes. I remember searching for Beatles on iTunes, and you would get things like the karaoke versions, the instrumentals, the cover versions, stuff like that, but never any Beatles, because the Beatles weren't on iTunes for years.
I mean, in some ways, that's, in that case, it's kind of, there's a legitimate reason to be there, because people might actually want to listen to the songs, but not actually be able to listen to them in this case. But when the actual artists are there, it seems a bit pointless to have all these sort of, you know, tribute acts and stuff like that. What Mulligan did is he looked at 10 superstar artists on iTunes, and he found that the proportion, the average proportion of artist tracks available is just 10%, dipping as low as 4% in some cases, compared to the amount of just nonsense heaped on top of it.
So I suppose the question, well, the statement is digital music is drowning in filler drivel. Surely this is one of those things where it's only affecting the mainstream and not the long tail, or the, you know, a lot of the bands I listen to, you're not getting karaoke versions of a lot of that, a lot of those sorts of bands, but you are getting a lot of Lady Gaga and Justin, you know, that guy.
Bieber?
But yeah. That probably forms the kind of largest volume of searches. So.
Yeah, it certainly does. And in all the research that people have done, it seems that the long tail is very, very... well, it's very long, but it's very narrow, I guess, in terms of digital music. The vast majority of digital music services are very, very hit-driven. And the vast, vast bulk of the music that is listened to on things like Spotify, iTunes and so on is the, you know, the top 100 or so artists. They account for by far the most plays.
Are users getting confused, though? Do you think it's a confusing...
What, you think that annoying. People are buying these things by accident?
Yeah, I mean, is it confusing? I mean, I don't know, I can't...
I was going to say, isn't this something that's addressed by the Rosetta Stone? What's the company who makes that software that does the unique ID for an artist and songs across all these digital music services?
Do you mean Music Brains?
There's Gracenote.
Or Gracenote, perhaps?
No.
There's a few sort of like fingerprinting services.
It's called the Rosetta Stone, and they've integrated it into Songkick and various other different platforms. And it provides a unique identifier so that you avoid this problem. So it pulls in the kind of official songs and official artist rather than these kind of endless copies.
But so what's the motivation though for iTunes to not put this stuff in? You know, because they're going to get sales off it. So,
well,
so
could they?
And it's legal for people to do these things.
It is.
Why is it happening in the first place? And B, is it actually a problem? Do we think it's a problem?
Well, let's be honest. They're probably doing it because it's easy money. It is perfectly legal to do a cover of a song as long as it's very similar to the original without paying any license fee. And basically the people who sell the records, I think, have to pay a small cut to PRS for music, at least in the UK.
It's publishing, yeah. You have to pay publishing, but you don't pay recording royalties.
So you could do a cover version and a karaoke version, because a few people might buy it here and there, and it costs peanuts to do a cover because you can do it on your iPad probably these days quite easily, particularly for pop songs. So,
but one kind of thing that Mulligan picked out is that this pseudo long tail, as he calls it, a kind of fake long tail, is actually obscuring the real long tail of more experimental music, you know, buzz bands and niche genres and things like that. And it's actually making it difficult to find these things. And I'm not necessarily sure that I agree with that argument. Well, just because it's drowning it out in a kind of weight of stuff.
But how is searching for a Lady Gaga song, finding that there are loads of covers, preventing you from otherwise finding an indie kind of band that only exists in
I think it
Aylesbury.
Depends on the platform though, doesn't it? I mean,
it
certainly
does.
On something like iTunes, you're probably looking to buy, whereas on Spotify, I would guess anecdotally are looking sometimes to discover, and you might be looking for bands like Lady Gaga, and what you're actually getting is a lot of Lady Gaga karaoke mixes.
Yeah, absolutely. And also there's the kind of aspect of how long this trend is likely to continue, because he kind of pointed out that at the end of towards the end of the last decade, there was pretty much all of the majors had their catalogues on most digital music services. Most of the big independent labels were on there. But since then, the catalogue has continued to grow massively of these services. And now these increasing numbers actually mean nothing, because all the important stuff has been there now for a while. And all that's being added is this drivel.
I think the problem that we're seeing here, though, isn't the biggest problem. The actual drivel is most of these artists' releases, because they'll release an album of 12 songs and only 10 of them are crap.
I think we're getting missing the point slightly.
Come on, if we're going to talk about musical drivel cluttering up, you know, actual good artists.
You're just grinding an axe here, Nate.
I'm just saying. Come on. Remix albums of a same single. I've seen Gaga do this. I have a lot of time and respect for Gaga, actually, but I've seen these remix EPs where it's 7 or 8 remixes for £3. It's a pointless money grab, and that is cluttering up iTunes, if you ask me. Should we move on? Actually, that's the end of the show. Should we finish the show?
Yeah.
Let us know what you think. Again, podcast at wired.co.uk. I can't speak.
Wired.co.uk?
Yeah, thanks. Do let us know. Liv,
yes.
Let's take my axe that I have ground down to a fine point and end the show.
I will do. Yeah, you can call us if you want to leave us a message. You can call us on 0208 123 0468 and it'll be charged at a UK local rate. Or you can call us on Wired UK Podcast on Skype for free. Leave us a message, but only up to 30 seconds. We don't want your rants. We don't want your axes being ground. Just 30 seconds. And then you can follow us on Twitter. We're at Wired UK. And of course, we are still on Facebook, facebook.com/WiredUK.
Like a pro. And I think on that note, we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
What?
I was hoping you'd say penis.
No, I'm not going to say penis.